You are listening to The Loop Podcast, a project in plastic surgery innovation.
Hello, everyone. Today's episode is an in-service review of anesthesia, as it pertains to plastic surgery, of course. I'm Yasmin Burns, and today I have with me guest host Mallory Alexis from Florida State University College of Medicine in Tallahassee, Florida. Thank you for putting together this episode today. First, tell us a little about yourself.
Thanks, Yasmin. Hey, everyone. Like Yasmin said, I'm Mallory Alexis. I grew up in South Florida in Broward County. I actually went to Florida A&M University, or FAMU, a historically Black university in Tallahassee, Florida, where I completed an accelerated pharmacy program and received my PharmD in 2019. As Yasmin mentioned, I am an MS1 currently right now, and a fun fact, my interest in PRS actually came about unexpectedly. So I kind of had a personal experience with family that had to deal with reconstructive surgery, but it wasn't as in-depth as my experience going to medical school, where the University of South Florida, they hosted an event with their plastic surgery interest group, and they invited us FSU students who don't have a program to come in and listen. And the residency director, he presented his journey through plastic surgery. He talked about the myths about plastic surgery and kind of delve into reconstructive surgery. And I just really fell in love, fell in a rabbit hole, started Googling a whole bunch of things. And then I found The Loop Podcast. And here I am now on The Loop Podcast. Pretty amazing. So I'm excited to be here and I'm excited to do this podcast.
That's awesome, Mallory. I mean, it's so hard when you don't have a home program to get that exposure. So props to you for going after what you're passionate about. And I got to say, when I was assigning the episodes, I saw the farm degree next to your name. And first of all, I was super impressed. And then I was like, hey, can you do the anesthesia episode? Because you're going to have some expertise there. So thank you very much for your hard work in putting this episode together. Can you tell us what resources were used for this episode?
Yes, of course. So I used Review of Plastic Surgery by Donald Buck, the first and second edition, Essentials of Plastic Surgery, and Graben Smith. We also went through the past 5 years of in-service exams and did a keyword search for relevant questions to include the takeaways from those questions in the episode. So again, today's topic is on anesthesia, which for the most part can be separated into general, regional, and local anesthesia, and then complications associated with anesthesia.
Yeah, this is definitely a bit of a dense episode, but stay with us because we're going to be covering some good content for the in-service. And then at the end, we'll do a little rapid fire Q&A to cover some high yield facts that don't fit in with the rest of the episode. This is not an exhaustive review like usual, but we will focus on some of the most important topics to know for the exam and for clinical practice. Okay, so let's dive in, and starting off broadly with differentiating between general and local anesthesia. So Mallory, can you walk us through that?
Yes, of course. So general anesthesia affects the whole body and induces a loss of consciousness, whereas local anesthesia involves a small area of the body being anesthetized. Local anesthesia is often used without concurrent general anesthesia, so the patient maintains consciousness.
What about when people say regional anesthesia? What do they mean by that?
Typically, regional anesthesia is referring to nerve blocks where you anesthetize larger named nerves, resulting in anesthesia of a larger part of the body, such as the entire anterior abdominal wall or an entire leg or arm. We will touch on a few examples of this a little later on.
Yeah, we definitely will, because those are super high yield. And two other types of anesthesia that are important to mention, along with general, regional, and local, but that we will not go in depth into, are MAC or MAC, which stands for Monitored Anesthesia Care, and Neuraxial Anesthesia. Local, regional, and neuraxial anesthesia can all be used with MAC, which is defined as sedation provided by an anesthesia provider. This is different from conscious sedation provided by a nurse, since the anesthesia provider can rescue the airway if greater anesthesia than intended is achieved. But starting off with general anesthesia, can you briefly describe the different routes of administration used during general anesthesia?
Yeah, so there is IV induction, which is primarily used for inducing anesthesia, or sedative anesthesia, which usually induces rapid acting and hypnotic agents. Inhalation is often used for the maintenance of anesthesia after IV anesthesia, including gases like nitrous oxide and volatile agents.
Let's first discuss IV administration. Can you walk us through the use of various IV induction agents?
Yes, of course. So I'll start off with the infamous propofol, an induction agent that is metabolized by the liver. And propofol's mechanism of action is unclear. However, it appears that it causes global CNS depression, presumably through agonism of GABA receptors, and perhaps reduce glutamatergic activity through NMDA receptor blockade. Side effects include profound vasodilation, which can lead to decreased preload and afterload, and inhibition of the Barrett reflex. Other side effects include respiratory depression, decreased airway reflexes, and a burning sensation upon administration. This agent is contraindicated in patients with hypotension. There is a syndrome associated with this agent called propofol-related infusion syndrome, which is rare yet often fatal syndrome. It is seen with high doses and prolonged use. The proposed risk factors include children, critical illness, high fat and low carb intake, and inborn errors of mitochondrial fatty acid oxidation. Hallmark signs of this syndrome include refractory bradycardia, severe metabolic acidosis, cardiovascular collapse, rhabdomyolysis, hyperlipidemia, renal failure, and hepatomegaly. Ooh, that was a lot of information. Let's move on to the next agent that can be used for IV induction.
Ketamine has a rapid onset due to its high lipophilic properties. However, this agent is associated with psychotropic side effects such as hallucinations, confusion, and euphoria. Ketamine preserves reflexes with open eyes, nystagmus, salivation, and dilated pupils. It's also the only induction agent that increases blood pressure and heart rate.
Great information. Good to know that ketamine has a different side effect profile compared to the other induction agents. Can you tell us more about the use of opioids during general anesthesia?
Yeah, so opioids are often used as an adjunct to anesthesia for analgesia. Opioids bind to mu, kappa, delta, and sigma receptors. The mu receptors are associated with analgesia. The most common agents include fentanyl, fentanyl synthetic derivatives like sufentanil or remifentanil and alfentanil, as well as morphine, hydromorphone, and meperidine. Fentanyl and its derivatives are often used because they're 100 to 150 times more potent than morphine, and they have a rapid onset. High doses of fentanyl and morphine can cause vagus nerve-mediated bradycardia. Morphine can also lead to a histamine response, which can lead to a drop in blood pressure.
So what about agents used for muscle paralysis?
So neuromuscular blocking drugs, which are useful for muscle paralysis as well as rapid induction. There are two categories of agents, depolarizing and non-depolarizing. Succinylcholine is the only depolarizing agent that's still in use. This agent has a rapid onset and a short duration of action. Succinylcholine can be associated with hyperkalemia, though the rise in potassium is not always clinically significant, but its more feared complication is malignant hyperthermia, which we will actually talk a little more about in a few minutes. Treatment is supportive if that develops. Non-depolarizing agents are more commonly used over depolarizing agents with a longer duration of action, and examples of non-depolarizing agents include vecuronium and rocuronium. So that was a lot of information. We're almost done with general anesthesia, but let's first go into inhaled general anesthetics quickly.
Yeah, so inhaled agents are often used for the maintenance of anesthesia after IV induction and supplemented by IV opioids for pain and muscle relaxants or paralytics. The most commonly used today are isoflurane, sevoflurane, and desflurane.
So tell us more about these agents. How do they work and what are the side effects?
So inhaled anesthetics alter the activity of neuronal ion channels, particularly the fast synaptic neurotransmitter receptors like nicotinic acetylcholine, gamma-aminobutyric acid or GABA, and glutamate receptors. These agents are often called volatile gas anesthetics with the suffix ane or ane, and these agents and succinylcholine are known to cause malignant hyperthermia. So Yasmin, can you tell us more about malignant hyperthermia?
Yeah, definitely. This is really important. So malignant hyperthermia is a life-threatening hypermetabolic event that occurs after exposure to some inhaled anesthetics and depolarizing agents. Patients usually have a genetic susceptibility, which is autosomal dominant with variable penetrance. Clinical manifestations may include the following: increased end-tidal CO2, fever, tachycardia, arrhythmia, acidosis, muscle rigidity, tachypnea, skin flushing, and hypotension. Treatment includes, first and foremost, stopping the offending agent, but then also hyperventilation with 100% oxygen, dantrolene, and supportive care, including cooling blankets. And surgery must also be stopped. And then real quick, just wanted to mention one other inhaled anesthetic, nitrous oxide, which is not a volatile agent like the others, but it's used in conjunction with other inhaled anesthetics, and it has its own analgesic properties. It actually acts on an NMDA receptor similarly to ketamine, which is what creates that analgesia.
Sounds like we learned so much about general anesthesia so far. So let's move on to local anesthetics. What are the two classes and how do they exert their effects?
Local anesthetics reversibly inhibit nerve transmission by binding voltage-gated sodium channels in the nerve plasma membrane. The two classes are esters and amides. Ester agents are more rapidly hydrolyzed by plasmaceutical anesterases and therefore have a shorter duration of action, whereas amides are degraded by the liver and therefore tend to have a longer duration of action compared to esters.
And so what are the names of commonly used local anesthetics?
Procaine and chloroprocaine are commonly used esters. Lidocaine, bupivacaine, and ropivacaine are commonly used amides. Bupivacaine binds protein more, which leads to a longer duration of action. Cocaine is also a local anesthetic that does not fall into the two classes of anesthetics. The maximum dose of cocaine is 1.5 mg per kg or 100 milligrams in 70 kilogram adults. Cocaine is used less commonly, but it's still used sometimes in nasal procedures due to its vasoconstrictive properties, unlike most other local anesthetics, which are vasodilatory.
So speaking of maximum doses, isn't that a really common in-service question for local anesthetics?
Yes, it is. So let's take a moment to go through it really slowly with an example, because there is almost always a question on the exam that will ask you to do some variation of this calculation. This took a little while to make sense to me when I was first learning it. So you have to start with knowing the maximum concentrations of the most commonly used local anesthetics. I actually used Iowa Head and Neck Protocol to find this information because it was shockingly difficult to find in our classic textbooks that we use, but it's definitely still tested. So these numbers can vary slightly depending on the source, but in general, you have plain lidocaine maximum dose is 4.5 milligrams per kilogram with an absolute maximum of 300 milligrams per dose. Lidocaine with epinephrine maximum dose is 7 milligrams per kilogram with an absolute maximum of 500 milligrams per dose. Plain bupivacaine, which has the brand name Marcaine, maximum dose is 2.5 milligrams per kilogram. Some sources say 2 to 2.5, with an absolute maximum of 175 milligrams per dose. Bupivacaine with epinephrine maximum dose is 3 milligrams per kilogram with an absolute maximum of 225 milligrams per dose. So those are the most commonly used local anesthetics in the clinical setting. There are a couple others as well, but those are definitely the four highest yield ones. So you also have, then you have the concentration of the local anesthetic, which comes in a percent. So usually that is 0.25%, 0.5%, 1%, or 2%. Those are the most common. The easiest way that I've found to think about the concentration is that you take the percent and you move the decimal to the right one space, and then you get the number of milligrams per ml. So for 1% lidocaine, that means you have 10 milligrams per ml. And then once you have all of that information, then you do a calculation.
Okay, so then can you give us an example of the calculation? So what if you have, let's say, a 46 kilogram patient and you want to figure out what is the maximum mls of 0.5% lidocaine with epinephrine you can give them?
So do these steps in whatever order works for you. But for me, I start with the patient's weight, which is 46 kilograms. So since it's lidocaine with epinephrine, our maximum dose is 7 milligrams per kilogram, which means that you can give this patient a maximum of 46 times 7, which is 322 milligrams. And remember, the absolute maximum dose is 500 milligrams per dose. So we are still underneath that. So we are good. I'm just envisioning a potential trick question with a super heavy patient where the weight-based calculation actually takes you over the absolute max and they try to trick you with that. So you have to remember those numbers too. Then you have 0.5% as the concentration. You move the decimal point to the right one space. That means there are 5 milligrams of lidocaine in every ml. So you take 322 milligrams, which was the maximum milligram dose you could give your patient, and you divide it by 5 milligrams per ml, and the milligrams cancel out, and you're left with 64.4 mls. That is the maximum amount of 0.5% lidocaine with epinephrine that you can give this patient that weighs 46 kilograms. So Mallory, why do you think we can use a higher dose when the local anesthetic is given with epinephrine?
I think because epinephrine causes vasoconstriction, which reduces the systemic absorption of the local anesthetic.
Yep, that's exactly it.
So what if you use more than one local anesthetic together in a mixture? Is there anything you have to take into account there?
You can mix local anesthetics, and the thought behind that is you can sometimes get the benefit of a faster onset of action, like you would have with lidocaine, but with a longer effect like you would have with bupivacaine. But things do become less predictable, and the risk of overdosing on one of the anesthetics is higher when you start to mix them. And particularly with liposomal bupivacaine, brand name Exparel, that's a long-acting formulation of bupivacaine that uses liposomes to slowly release the anesthetic. Super commonly used intraoperatively because it has effects lasting up to 72 hours. When you use that, there are some extra considerations.
And what are those considerations? Like what?
So if you inject lidocaine first, you're supposed to wait at least 20 minutes prior to then injecting liposomal bupivacaine. If you don't, the lidocaine can have the effect of releasing the bupivacaine from the liposomes prematurely, which results in an extra high dose. And this was a question on last year's in-service exam. Also, it's generally not recommended to give any other local anesthetic for 96 hours after liposomal bupivacaine is given. Another interesting fact about liposomal bupivacaine is that it does not have a weight-based dosing, unlike the other local anesthetics that we were talking about. The maximum dose is either 20 ml or 266 milligrams, which seems like a super random number, but that was also tested last year. A little bit of a tangent about Exparel, but anyway.
So we've talked a lot about these maximum doses and how not to exceed them. But what exactly happens when we go above the maximum dose of lidocaine, like for example?
So for lidocaine, you can get lidocaine toxicity. But actually, the broader and more accurate term would be local anesthetic systemic toxicity, or LAST, LAST. But for our in-service, lidocaine is often used as an example. This is what would occur if the maximum dose of a local anesthetic was absorbed systemically, and it can happen either immediately after injection or more slowly over hours. Signs and symptoms of that include slurred speech, restlessness, tinnitus, metallic taste, perioral numbness, and bradycardia. Treatment with an IV bolus of 20% lipid emulsion at a starting dose of 1.5 mLs per kilogram.
And so what about allergic reactions associated with local anesthetics?
So a true allergy is rare. Contact type 4 hypersensitivity is actually more common with lidocaine. Amino esters are more likely to cause allergic reactions because of their metabolism to para-aminobenzoic acid, or PABA, a known antigen. Cross-sensitivity doesn't really occur, though. Ester-allergic patients can receive amides. In general, an allergy to a local anesthetic is more likely to be due to the preservatives in it than the anesthetic itself.
Okay, so what about anesthetic used in the context of liposuction?
So that is when you achieve local anesthesia via a wetting solution, such as that used for liposuction, by combining lidocaine and epinephrine with saline to create a dilute solution of local anesthetic can be safely injected into the local tissues. And this actually allows for much larger doses of lidocaine than you would otherwise be allowed to use. The maximum dose here is 35 milligrams per kilogram to 55 milligrams per kilogram, instead of the usual 7 milligrams per kilogram for lido with epi with a traditional, like, local anesthetic injection.
So if you did give too much lidocaine in your wetting solution, though, when would lidocaine toxicity set in?
The peak effect of lidocaine for subcutaneous administration is 12 to 14 hours after administration when it's used below the clavicles and 6 to 12 hours above the clavicles.
And what other lidocaine technique has a higher risk of lidocaine toxicity?
Beer block local anesthesia is a technique that uses a double tourniquet and IV administration of lidocaine to provide upper extremity anesthesia. Lidocaine toxicity can occur with this technique, especially if you have a non-functioning tourniquet, an inappropriate early release of the tourniquet, or a poorly functioning tourniquet, like one that doesn't fit right if it's too large for the extremity. The procedure should be limited to 20 to 30 minutes, and you should use a double bladder tourniquet so that deflation can be staged. And then risk factors for leaks with the tourniquet are associated with individuals who have funnel-shaped arms or hypertension. Mallory, what kind of anesthesia technique is the beer block an example of?
It's an example of regional anesthesia, and there are a lot of other examples that are relevant to plastic surgery, so that's a good segue.
Yep, many examples of regional anesthesia that we use in everyday practice as well. Some high-yield examples include the transversus abdominis plane or TAP block for the abdominal wall, which targets intercostal nerves. Different sources cite different levels that are covered, so there's no one right answer. Several go-to anesthesiology sources state that it's T6 through T12, whereas the 2021 in-service exam answer key cited it as T7 to L1. So I don't know. I mean, those are only different by one level. As long as you know the general range, plus or minus one, you should be able to get most of those questions right. There's also the pectoralis block, which targets medial and lateral pectoral nerves with a PEC-1 block. And then if you do the PEC-2 block, you do those, plus you also add a second injection between PEC minor and serratus anterior to target the intercostal and intercostobrachial nerves.
What about regional anesthesia in the finger?
Another example of regional anesthesia might be that, a digital block. So the traditional teaching with this was that you cannot use epinephrine with local anesthetic in the finger due to concern for digital ischemia. However, this teaching was based on experiences with co-injection of procaine and cocaine with epinephrine. And both of those substances can also cause digital ischemia themselves. And so that theory has kind of been debunked as it relates to epinephrine with some more commonly used local anesthetics that we've been talking about, like lidocaine and bupivacaine. So it is safe to use epinephrine-containing local anesthetics in the finger, as long as it's in commonly used concentrations like 1 to 100,000 or 1 to 200,000, for example. And the effects of that should spontaneously wear off within 12 hours. But to be extra safe, there are some precautions that you can take. Avoiding circumferential blocks. Don't use highly concentrated solution above what we normally would use. Don't use overly constrictive bandages afterwards. And avoid it in patients that already have vasospastic or thrombotic conditions. So Mallory, even though it's so rare for this to actually happen, if you did have an actual concern for digital ischemia after epinephrine injection, what could you use to treat that?
You can use phentolamine at a dose of 1 mg/mL, which reliably reverses epinephrine-induced vasoconstriction.
Yep, that's right.
What about topical anesthetics?
Topical anesthetics are usually a combination of formulations that are useful in children, especially, to provide anesthesia without the trauma of injection.
And what are some common topical anesthetics?
So LET, or lidocaine, epinephrine, and tetracaine. And then there's also EMLA, which stands for eutectic mixture of local anesthetics. But for EMLA, because it has prilocaine in it, it also has the potential to cause methemoglobinemia.
And can you tell us more about methemoglobinemia?
Yeah, methemoglobinemia is a rare life-threatening complication that can occur with some topical and local anesthetics. The anesthetic oxidizes the iron component of hemoglobin such that it cannot bind and transport oxygen. Signs and symptoms of this include graying of the skin, headache, weakness, cyanosis, brown discoloration of blood, arrhythmias, seizures, and anoxic brain injury. And treatment includes the administration of 100% oxygen and IV methylene blue.
Wow, we've covered so much in just a short time.
Yes, we have. But before we end, Let's do a couple of random little quiz questions about some pre- and post-operative considerations that are related to anesthesia. So, Mallory, what are some risk factors for post-operative nausea or vomiting?
Great question. The number one risk factor is previous history of post-op nausea and vomiting. Other risk factors include female sex, volatile gases / general anesthesia, opioid use, lung surgery, and facial rejuvenation.
What about the NPO guidelines prior to surgery? What are those?
No clear liquids 2 hours before surgery and no solid food 8 hours before surgery.
How is cardiac risk assessment determined?
Great question. Cardiac risk is dependent on risk factors for cardiac complications. Some examples include high-risk surgeries, such as vascular and heart surgery, history of ischemic heart disease, heart failure, cardiovascular disease, diabetes requiring insulin, creatinine greater than 2, functional status, placement of stents, 6 months of aspirin, and Plavix to continue even if surgery is indicated. EKG is recommended in patients with known coronary heart disease, arrhythmia, cardiovascular or peripheral arterial disease, or patients with structural heart disease.
So how do we ensure safe surgical outcomes? What can we do to risk stratify?
So the American Society of Anesthesiologists organizes and maintains the standards of the medical practice of anesthesiology and improves the care of the patient. So the ASA classifies individuals based on their overall health and surgical outcomes. Higher ASA is associated with a patient in poorer health and with a greater risk for morbidity and or mortality from surgery / anesthesia. Class 1 corresponds with healthy, class 2, a mild systemic disease, class 3, a severe systemic disease, and class 4, a severe systemic disease that is a constant threat to life. So that's actually all that we have for now. I hope everyone enjoyed listening and learning about anesthesia with us.
If you want to hear more episodes for In-Service Review, make sure and subscribe to us on your favorite podcast sites like Apple or Spotify. And then also make sure and follow us on Instagram as well to get in the loop. A special thank you to Dr. DJ Warfield, anesthesiology attending and program director of Regional Anesthesiology and Acute Pain Medicine Fellowship at Penn State Hershey, for his advice and help with content editing for this episode.